If you can't tell, Ray and I are the odd couple. We're different personality types. In fact, people who know us well say, oh, this will never work. I think it will. In fact, I describe our partnership by saying it's a perfect partnership. I'll make sure I'm really organizing. I'll make sure we get to the right city on the right day, and Ray's good enough that they'll enjoy us. I think it's ideal. And if you were at the concert
you
last...
You forgot to mention the part that was getting me there, too, right?
Yeah, I have to get him from Dubuque. And if you were at the concert last night, you know why I went into the partnership. I like to have that kind of music as part of my life. It's a delight, so... Maybe we could compromise a little bit while we're giving a few minutes for the people to come down from the dish team. I predict you're entering the fullest day of the retreat, the most centered time that you'll have, and I hope that it's just a delight. I told you that the retreat couldn't miss the mountains, as it happens also the blue sky and weather, the Holden community, worship here with the staff, meeting people who came on the retreat. It just can't miss. Dick Wiederanders used to say that the Holden winter Sunday schedule was the only civilized time he ever spent in his life. Started about 9:15, have the day free, eat a nice meal, worship, have some entertainment, dessert. He thought that was a very civilized day. And it has taken until now till you really kind of feel at home here. You remember when you first came and it looked like everybody else lived here, knew what to do, knew one another, and you kind of walked through this line of staff that was having a good time and you didn't know how things worked. You now know how long it takes for the hot water to get to the second floor of the hotel so that you can have your shower. You've found the newspapers, maybe the tape library. You know how the meal works and that you can get milk out of that funny little thing in the wall when you want cereal in the morning a little early. It takes that long. Tomorrow you'll be thinking about going back on the boat. I guarantee it. You'll be packing. And so this is the day. This is the full day. A couple people who know me well say, well, how are you doing? How do you feel about the retreat? I will admit that the part I miss, and I want to bring just a little bit into it at this point, or at least see if you want to do that. The part I miss is I'm used to about 18 people maximum on a retreat, and you really get to know one another, and there's a lot of sharing. It never feels like a performance or like I'm giving a talk. I'm part of a conversation, and I always look forward. We usually try to have like a three-hour worship service at the end. Comfortable, go and get coffee in the middle of it, but a lot of sharing. And then I find out what the experience has been for other people, and people get to contribute something, and everybody has something to contribute. So that piece, I haven't felt that we were able to do that. So let's just take a couple minutes with that as to, you know, how are you doing? Where are you? What do you want to share for just a minute? And we'll do that tomorrow a little bit, too. Okay? The strong introverts don't want to do that. That's all right.
Not for 3 hours.
No, we're not going to know. It's just time for the dish team to come down. That's all.
We don't have to prove it was a great retreat.
Hey, you got it. You got it. That was great. Hugh asked me at breakfast, why did you pick Galatians as a pre-Lenten retreat? I didn't really share much about how this came about, so let me do that for a minute. I knew that Marcus Borg was going to open up 5 sections of Luke scripture pre-Lenten, and that's why I signed up to come. I was looking forward to that. What Ray and I offer is something different, so I tried to design something that included our songs and stories, but also moved into a pre-Lenten theme. And of the things Ray and I offer in a brochure, Margaret picked nonviolence. Why don't you have that as the theme? And it struck me that of all the times that I have presented nonviolence, and you got some of that yesterday, especially in the stories, I have never turned to Galatians for that. But the phrase, "for freedom, Christ has set us free," struck me as a good pre-Lenten retreat, as a phrase. I wanted to expand on that, and since that was in the middle of a letter, I wanted to find out why that seemed to be a kind of summary after all of the theology and Paul defending the gospel from any other thing being added onto it, why he used that phrase. So I thought, is it possible to talk about nonviolence through talking about freedom? That's how it came about. And I don't know what the conclusion will be, whether it is or not. I mean, that's why I really said you can do your own kind of reading in Galatians and find some things that click with you, share that back. So does that, I don't know that that helps, but I was glad you felt free to write or to ask me at breakfast. And Dan Erlander yesterday at noon said, probably we don't feel just how radical that section about isolation, that we're all one in Christ, neither male nor female, Gentile nor Jew, slave nor free. We don't feel that as strongly as though we had lived in a country where having an enemy is part of what it means to live in that country. Dan, what examples did you use? The Russian, or the pastor, Estonian pastor, just...
Well, the example is part of, like, Estonian identity is that Russians are enemies, or Serbs and Croatians and Bosnians. It's part of you just growing up as a child, as you learn, but part of your cultural identity is to have this group as an enemy that you learn to hate from a very early childhood.
And that really hasn't been our experience. So it's even more radical, I think, than we think when we read it. So those, when I...
Jews and Gentiles are probably closer to that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anybody else have something they want to share before we move on? Okay, let's sing Simple Gifts. Today we're on accumulation. I wrote another word down, addiction. Interesting way to think. Then you really can get at freedom. If our accumulation of stuff or our needs for things is an addiction, then maybe we can talk about freedom. Simple Gifts on the yellow sheet.
Do people know this song? Here we go. We'll sing it kind of lightly the first time through anyway. Tis a gift
to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, it will be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn will be our delight, till by turning we come round right.
Okay, we'll do it one more time. For those that might not have known it, that's kind of catching on. Here we go.
Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, we'll be in the valley of love and delight. when true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round right.
Thank you, Ray. I got fouled up in my the fruits of the spirit column because I had this one as the clearest one, generosity. And I got here and opened the Bible that's here, RSV, and generosity is not one of the fruits of the Spirit. So obviously I had either the new RSV or something back home. Does anybody have a Bible that says generosity? I can't find, just because the word fits better, it's really not fair to good biblical exegesis. The one that I have here says goodness. But I think generosity is another legitimate translation, and then that's really what we're talking about today, one of the fruits of the Spirit being generosity, freed from new RSV. Thank you, thank you. The United Church of Christ has it straight. Huh?
Right.
What I'd like to do, and we had a good conversation with Scott Hasserud. His Myers-Briggs type doesn't like charts, so he's resisting this with all of his heart. And if you are, just think of it as a cylinder, but I just couldn't bring it. Just think of that it goes around, or that it rolls this way.
There's a barber pole.
Barber pole. That's what it is, okay? You really have to be careful with the Myers-Briggs type when you're around Scott Hasserud. So The point is that I would like to start with the cultural assumption. What is freedom in regard to things and stuff and money and that in the culture?
More is better.
More is better. The more you have, the happier you'll be. Just name some others.
The guy with the most at the end wins.
The guy with the most at the end wins. Okay?
And it's always a guy.
Now we're coming. All right. What does it do? What does this cultural assumption do to this part of our isolation? If the person who has the most at the end wins, what does that say about the relationship to the other people? Competitors. Dan Erlander is still working on. I wonder if I brought that.
Naturally, the guy doesn't end up with it. The guy dies and leaves it to his wife. A woman always ends up with it.
Dan Erlander is still working on something that he and I heard up here together, and he has got about four installments called The Pointless People, but it all started with a piece by Ann Herbert, who was a speech teacher at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. This is Genesis 1. It's just a little liberty taken with the text. In the beginning, God didn't make just two people. God made a bunch of us. God wanted to have a lot of fun, and he said, you can't really have fun unless there's a whole gang of you. So God put us in Eden, which was a combination garden and playground and park, and God told us to have fun. At first, we all did have fun, just like God expected. We rolled down the hills, waded in the streams, climbed on the trees, swung on the vines, ran in the meadows, frolicked in the woods, hid in the forests, and acted silly, and we laughed a lot. Then one day this snake told us that we weren't having real fun because we weren't keeping score. We didn't know what score was, but when the snake explained it, we still couldn't see any fun in it. But then the snake said we should give an apple to the person who was the best at all the games, and we'd never know who was best unless we kept score. Now we could see the fun, because we were all sure we were the best. It was different after that. We yelled a lot. We had to make up new scoring rules for most of the games. Others, like frolicking, we stopped playing. They were just too hard to score. By the time God found out what had happened, we were spending about 45 minutes a day actually playing. The rest of the time, we were working out the scoring. And God was wroth about that. Very, very wroth. He said we couldn't use his garden anymore because we weren't having fun. We told him we were having lots of fun, that God was just being narrow-minded because it wasn't exactly the kind of fun that God had originally thought of, but God wouldn't listen. He kicked us out. And he said, or God said, she said, we couldn't come back until we stopped keeping score. To rub it in, to get our attention, God said, we were told that we were all going to die and that our scores wouldn't mean anything anyway. Well, God was wrong. My cumulative all-game score is 16,548, and that means a lot to me. If I can raise it to 20,000 before I die, I'll know I've accomplished something. And even if I can't, my life has a great deal of meaning because I've taught my children to score high. They'll be able to reach 20,000, even 30,000. Really, it was life in the garden that didn't mean anything. Fun is great in its place, but without scoring, there's no reason for it. God actually has a very superficial view of life. And I'm certainly glad my children are being raised away from God's influence. We were very lucky, and we are very grateful to the snake. Just imagine the freedom of seeing that as God's word in our culture. That's what we have to break out and do. Let me share just a couple things, cultural things, from my notebook on accumulation and enough is enough and other things to just realize how counterculture will really be today. This is in the days right after World War II. A retailing analyst named Victor Lebeau prophetically set the tone for the coming era, including the era we are now in. He's a retailing analyst. Quote, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption a way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing rate. End of quote. And we rose to the challenge. And the rest of the world has tried to follow. And we not only have risen to the challenge, we now have the temple for all of this. It's called the Mall of America, and it's in Bloomington, Minnesota. Or, Ellen Gamrath sent me this from the Seattle Times, October 4th, 1992. Jennifer James. I asked an audience of 400 executives to vote recently on a question of the common good. I asked them if they would be willing to give up 2% of their power, privilege, position, status, and money for the common good. I offered in exchange a stronger democracy, a better quality of life for many more Americans, less violence, healthier children, and a sense of fairness. They voted by means of a 10-key pad on each of their chairs, and their vote was anonymous. I would like to ask you to take a minute and vote too. What would you be willing to give up and for whom? Do you feel that you've earned all your privileges, that therefore are not required to share regardless of the cost to your country? Or do you feel that you have had advantages or been fortunate in history and economics, and that you can afford to offer a small gesture to others, especially children? I pose similar questions about equality for women and minorities to some high school students last month. Many were angry at the suggestion that they eliminate even their physical dominance of others, or to share. I wondered where young people could have gotten such attitudes. How would you vote on equality and nonviolence? How did you vote on my first question about the common good? The executives turned me down. They made it clear that most would not give up one dime for the common good. They told me they had earned everything they had. They did not think that they were privileged, and what happened to their communities was not important as long as they maintained the status quo. I found out where many of the high school students got their attitude. Parents applied pressure and got me fired from my next lecture in that district. I was unsuitable, they said. Or this is from a Jewish rabbi, Daniel Polish. This was in the Star Tribune of in Minneapolis on January 6, 1984. Jews are uncomfortable reading about Ivan Boskys or Dennis Levines who are engaged in one financial dishonesty or another. Well, the Jewish community needn't worry. As the financial pages look more and more like some mutation of the National Enquirer, it is clear that avarice is an equal opportunity vice. The pervasiveness of these scandals throws one profoundly troubling truth into stark relief. All of the religious traditions of America have failed and failed miserably to instill values in their adherents. All have been defeated by a common foe. The rantings of the religious right are a diversion. The common foe is not secular humanism, whatever that is, he puts in parenthesis. The great moral issues of the moment are not pornography. The false value that has triumphed over the teachings of all religious communities is the implicit ethic of our economic system, namely looking out for number one. None of the admonitions to charity, compassion, and honesty have withstood this ethic of self-advancement at any cost, which lies at the heart of the unbridled competition that is necessary to succeed in the terms of our socioeconomic system. As the game gets increasingly frantic and complex, is it any wonder that some players will want the field tilted in their favor? Perhaps we should be less concerned about the players and more worried about the rules of the game. Of all the religious bodies in the country in recent years, only the Roman Catholic bishops have had the courage to question the system by which our economy functions. And as a kind of other side to that, someone trying to talk about what freedom would be in the midst of that, Maria Manas was a newspaper writer, a good one. I think the New York Times, but this is a quote from her. The good life exists only when you stop wanting a better one. It is the condition of savoring what is rather than longing for what might be. The itch for things so brilliantly injected by those who make and sell them is in effect a virus, draining the soul of contentment. A man never earns enough. A woman is never beautiful enough. Clothes are never new enough. The house is never furnished enough. The food is never fancy enough. There is a point at which salvation lies in stepping off the escalator of saying, enough. What I have will do, and what I make of it is up to me. Those are just a few of the kind of things that are part of the fabric of what we're doing today. Let me tell you one story about fitting this with where we started. Our slavery's spring from what we're trying to prove and to whom. I had led many, many retreats on lifestyle issues. I think I do that with grace, not a guilt trip. I think I do that without asceticism. You know what that is? That's denying that things are good. This is denying that God has given us rich and abundant, and we should give thanks for it. It's a refusal to enjoy. I don't think that's what we're talking about. Or scrupulosity. Karin Erlander said, did you make that up? Isn't that a word? Scrupulosity? Okay. Or, as I said the other day, simpler than thou. I think I present it with that we should be grateful and celebrate life, but that the real ripoff comes when we are convinced that we should have insatiable appetites, because that means you're never content. That's just robbing you of contentment. So take the scripture passage that God gives full measure, rich and overflowing. It's the image of a basket that's full. That's scriptural. But what I rebel against is a culture that says, well, if your basket's full, get a bigger one. So that it's never full. Then we wonder why we don't have Eucharistic living or Thanksgiving. Verlon Brown said consistently since he's been here as pastor, when someone has come from another country, a poor country, and shares on Solidarity Meal Day, inevitably there are 2 points. I couldn't believe how happy those folks were, or how hopeful they were, point one, and I couldn't believe how generous they were. A family with 2 goats killed one to feed us. Half of what they owned was spent in hospitality. So I try to stress Eucharistic living whenever I give this kind of presentation, but I almost always give it to middle-class people who could choose to simplify their life if they wanted to. And I always feel a little, you know, is this a middle-class luxury? Most of the world lives simply because they have to. Here we are sitting around and waiting for a 4:15 dinner when we just had those French toast talking. I mean, I know that, so do you, okay. But Effie Lee, she was poor, and she had come to the retreat on a scholarship, and she just looked at me from Friday night, all day Saturday, she hadn't said a word, into Sunday. I mean, I liked her, but I didn't really know what she was thinking. Sunday morning, you know what we had? 3-hour Eucharist. We had decorated the room with whatever they wanted to bring in, something from their walk or something they had read. The altar was a guitar case because music had been important, and the bread and the wine were on the guitar case. But I said, one of the offerings is we all should share something about what the retreat meant to me. And near the end, Effie said, I'll say, This is what I've been thinking during the retreat, and I really thought I might just get it and maybe deserve it. Just before I came on the retreat, she said, I'd almost bought a new kitchen table and 4 chairs. She said, I may be poor, but I'm not stupid. I know what the interest rate would have been. Where I can buy, the interest rate, this is 1968, is 28%. She said, do you know why I was going to buy the kitchen table? Because I had been convinced that I was not a worthwhile mother because my table was shabby. This is what the weekend has said to me. I don't need a new kitchen table to be a worthwhile person. And I hugged her. I'll travel anywhere to free people from the idea that their worth is connected with their kitchen table. Anywhere. That's what we're talking. She was freed. And I thought, how do you get invitations to people who are not middle class, but who do need some sense of what it means to be free? This culture tells us that we are the losers if we're not at a certain... Just think of the millions of dollars that go into the ads that connect your worth with what you have. And the kids get to Sunday school and stories about Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount after 350,000 tennis shoe ads, or Pump 'em Up, or why? Quality is a certain kind of beer. Just think of the industry that is out to undermine an idea of freedom, not scrupulosity, undermine an idea of freedom so that we are never content. Ray and I were talking about how does this one really fit freedom? And I thought of some pastors I know, I thought of some people I know who are in jobs that they don't like. I thought of us going to PLU and students who are planning for something that maybe really isn't their gift. And I thought, it is a freedom issue. I thought of a very old story about Greek philosophers. Diogenes lived well by living in the palace and saying the things the king wanted to hear. And he walked by Aristarchus' house, and Aristarchus was eating lentils. And Diogenes said, if you would only cultivate the king, you wouldn't have to live on lentils. And Aristarchus answered, if you would learn to live on lentils, you wouldn't have to suck up to the king. There is a level of freedom. There is a level of freedom. The Peterson Kingdom family here have a mutual good friend with me. His name is Larry Peterson. Larry and Mary Peterson is the only parsonage I ever went to where we drank goat's milk from the goat out in the front yard. I used to love to go to their house. They had decided what their needs were for a salary, and they let that be known because they wanted a call. There was a little parish near Custer in the Dakotas, and that little parish needed a pastor, and the synod had said there's no pastor in the ELCA, or the old ALC, who can live on what you can afford. They didn't know about Larry and Mary. They were thousands below the median income for ALC pastors. So they got to move where they wanted to move. And I used to tell the story, if you as a pastor have needs in three figures, your mobility is nil. If your needs are low, you can go anywhere in the church, to any parish you choose that's open. Do you catch the kind of freedom if, and I don't especially like lentils, but I was telling the story the way I heard it, the freedom that comes when your needs are low. I'm going to give you a freebie today. You've been so good. This is a freebie, because when I do it in Minneapolis, it's going to cost $50. I'm going to take an ad in the paper, in the Star Tribune, and get a room at the Holiday Inn near the airport in Bloomington, and it's going to be guaranteed, money-back guarantee. This session on Saturday morning will double your riches. $50, money-back guarantee. They're all going to be in the room, and I'm going to walk out and say, this is all I need to say, cut your needs in half. I'm afraid to do it. I Isn't that true? Isn't that true? Our slavery spring from what we're trying to prove and to whom. I want Ray to sing the most counter-cultural song he has ever written.
What is this?
Anything better to do?
All right, well, we'll sing it together.
Yeah.
This is a song about I'm sitting down, so I'll stand up. Not on your sheet, folks. You gotta learn this by heart. Well, you've given such a good intro down with all of this stuff. I don't even know what to do, so we'll just sing it. But it is based on a true experience in my life, as I've been struggling to live a different way. Early Monday morning. Dawn was breaking the dark. Early morning in the park. The birds were all singing away. This walk I was taking, cause bad dreams had shaken my spirit, and I'd awakened dismayed. So I stopped, settled down to a spot on the ground to watch the sun welcome the day. I started feeling at ease from my worries released, when a voice from behind me exclaimed, haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Haven't you anything better to do than to sit there and smile? Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Here I've been thinking this was the best thing I'd done for a while. Next time that comes around, I'll sing that along with you. Well, I quick turned around to the source of this sound, these unpleasant words to my ear.
It was an elderly lady thinking, maybe I should be someplace but here. Or is this what she means, that a grown man in blue jeans is probably wasting his time sitting this way at the start of the day, watching the stunned sun start to climb? Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Haven't you anything better to do than sit there and smile? Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Here I've been thinking that this was the best thing I've done for a while. Well, it bothered me some to be treated kind of like a bum, greeted with such rude display. And as my feelings grew caustic, my mind was at a loss to explain why I sat there this way. Or is this? So I pondered the facts. Can a man ever sit and relax and still know he's okay? Or was I simply a jerk for not being at work at 6:30 a.m. on a Monday? Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Haven't you anything better to do than sit there and smile? Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? I've been thinking this was the best thing I'd done for a while. So I walked home recovering, called up a brother and said, let's play tennis till 10. Our game was so splendid, when we had ended, we promised next Monday we'd do it again. After the match, as I soaked in my bath, thinking, gee, I should get to work soon. I took a sip of my tea, then I thought of that lady, and I sat there till mid-afternoon. Haven't you anything better to do today than sit there? Haven't you anything better to do than to sit there and smile? Haven't you anything better to do than sit there? Here I've been thinking this was the best thing I'd done for a while. And I just went right on thinking this was the best thing I'd done for a while.
Thank you. I'd like you to do just that. Simplest little exercise for me. We want to pass these around. If you don't have paper, I hope you have pencils. I don't think we have a supply of pencils. If you don't have a pencil or something to write with, you'll have to keep it in your hip. I think it'll be more helpful for you if you write. Here's one pencil. And you can. Margaret, are there any more available, like in the resource center?
Yeah, I didn't get some.
How many do not have a pencil? Yeah, we got about a dozen. Here's one, and you can share them because it's not an exhaustive test.
Can I use pens?
Yeah, pens are fine.
I have a pen, my favorite pen. Who needs one? I'll sit by you. Does somebody else want one?
Let me see if I can find some.
Go ahead. I thought we had a whole bunch of hands. Okay, who wants? Who's the best?
It doesn't have to be everything. If you want to guess on the number of shirts or blouses or sweaters, if you want to get down to that. Shoes. Jewelry. Oh, it's all stolen?
Yeah. I lost.
I make you
listen. That's why this is pretty short. Someone has a good time.
Yeah. Wait, just give me simple, though.
It used to be nice. Who needs jewelry?
do that side further sometime, and I'm going to give you something else to do with it. But the other side is a different list. I take sheer delight in joy, gifts in my life. I've given you three ways for the column. Any of those things that you think of when I say I take sheer delight in, these are gifts to me, gives me great joy. Make a list of things that fit. You got, okay. That's on the right side. I ask you to just think about the process, maybe about your lists. Is there anything on both lists? I hope so. Can you imagine that there would have been a time when someone had people on the left as things they owned and still are in the world, probably? On the left, did you know in a monastery that you would bring that list every year to the abbot, at least at the Benedictine monastery where I know, and I assume it's true of women's orders too, then you'd come to the prioress. And the abbot or the prioress would say, that's too many of this or this, and you would de-accumulate every year as an act of freedom. I don't want Father Abbot, I don't think, coming into my home, but I wish I did that every year. Freely, I have a friend who gives something away every day, just as a spiritual discipline. So one of the sure ways that it's not an addiction is, can you give it away? I'm not sure we can really have it unless we could give it away. How do we find out when we're grasping it too much instead of using it freely? When are we a slave and when we aren't a slave? I'm not sure anybody can tell that for you. I know William Stringfellow, he was one of my favorite theologians. He was a lawyer in Harlem all of his life, an Episcopal layman, sharp theologian. And one time he was just ready to get on an airplane and an Episcopal priest called up and said, Mr. Stringfellow, there's a family in my office and they're going to be evicted from their apartment and they have small children. And their furniture will be put on the street. And he said, what's the reason for eviction? And he asked the couple and answered Stringfellow, non-payment of rent. He said, there's nothing you can do in New York City. That's reason for eviction. They're going to be out on the street. And the guy said, but they have a family. Their furniture is going to be placed out. They'll have no place to stay tonight. Stringfellow said, take down one of those damn tapestries from the front of your church, sell it and pay their rent. And he hung up. And he got on the airplane, he thought, gee whiz, that was awful. I was in a hurry, and I didn't, I mean, that was an honest phone call. Then he thought to himself, no, I was out of line. But no tapestry should hang in a church legitimately unless we were free to any time take it down, sell it, and pay somebody's rent. I mean, he kind of thought through theologically what was going on there. Obviously, you probably know, I think you will be rich in proportion to how many things are on the right side of your sheet. In fact, theologically, everything is gift. Even our life is gift. We don't own anything. So that's not getting into scrupulosity or asceticism. It's... Can you kind of feel the difference between things that I own and the marvelous abundance of all that I have in life as gift? That's really all I'm trying to do today, of talking about how we come to a point of freedom with our stuff. I think one of the most exciting ministries in the United States churches is the ministry of money out of the Church of the Savior. It's just a very creative, instead of instead of always feeling guilty about it or having your whole life centered in it, it's gift. And Don McLennan and those other people do a marvelous job of retreats around money. One night in the Community of Christ in Washington, D.C., that's the total agenda, was our money. We all said what we made, how much insurance we thought was necessary, what we had in savings, what we spent on vacations, and there wasn't a single person in the room who didn't say, I have never shared this with anybody before. My relatives don't know these things. We took a step in this culture toward community. You can talk sex before you talk money in this culture with less embarrassment. So all I'm saying is, if that's true, then it's not a very freeing thing for us. I think you're with it. And the fire's going to strike later when all this gets thought through and stuff. But that's the point I want to make. And work on that list. Work on that list. You might know Gerhard Frost has a poem about it. Little sisters, 4 and 6, today the mail brought what they liked and looked for, a catalog, replete with many colored pictures. The first to page it was the 6-year-old. She turned each page possessively, saying, wherever she found what pleased her, I want this, I want this, and this. The litany of selfishness ended. Came the moment of the 4-year-old, she who didn't know the why of catalogs, turn pages. She pointed too, but the words were new. We got this. We got that. We got this. I want. We have. What a difference it would make in this our global village if 4-year-old love and wisdom ruled the day. I don't want to stay away from the controversial aspects of Jesus' words and make this without some challenge, and probably the best way to do that is with a song instead of a sermon. What did Jesus say about all this?
Jesus said some pretty clear stuff. In fact, I just have a song which kind of restates it and would help you restate it in your own mind. The chorus of this song goes like this.
Go, sell what you have, sell what you have, and give it away to the poor. Sell what you have, then come and follow me.
Want to give that a try? Go sell what you have.
Go sell what you have. Sell what you have, and give it away to the poor. Sell what you have, then come and follow me.
Have you heard the story about the rich man? Here we go.
Give it away, give it away. Who asked Jesus how to get to the promised land?
Give it away, give it away.
Well, he had kept all the commandments, everyone.
Give it away, give it away.
There was just one thing that he had left undone.
Give it away, give it away.
And go sell what you have, sell what you have, and give it away to the poor. Sell what you have, then come and follow me.
When the rich man heard the word that Jesus said,
give it away, give it away,
he walked away sadly, shaking his head.
Give it away, give it away.
For though his walk was straight and his path was sure,
give it away, give it away.
When he passed by the gate, he could not touch the poor.
Give it away, give it away.
And go sell what you have, sell what you have, and give it away to the poor. Sell what you have, then come and follow me.
Well, have you heard the one about the camel?
Give it away, give it away.
Who tried to squeeze through the eye of a needle?
give it away, give it away. Oh yes, it's hard to get the heavy laden through. Give it away, give it away. So lighten up your load and see what God can do. Give it away, give it away. And go, sell what you have, sell what you have. And give it away to the poor, sell what you have. Then come and follow me.
Then come.
Then come and follow me.
One more time, it was what Jesus said.
Then come and follow me, Jesus said.
Thank you. What I'd like to do tomorrow, I promised you we'd fill in the chart so that you could just copy it off the board if you haven't done it, if you want to do that. But I'd like to start making some connections among the four kind of themes that we've taken. For instance, today, an accumulation, I don't think we will leave our security for a new way of life. Jesus offered a new kind of security. I think if your old age and your medical care and your social security and all of that is in the culture, it'll be very hard for you to be counterculture. Most of our churches don't offer an alternative to that. For instance, look at the connection between isolation or individualism and accumulation. We all have to take care of ourselves. We all have to have all of our own tools. We all think of the difference it would be if we were more communal. We have just the start toward that in our community. Four of us own two cars. It's a marvelous start. It's more economical and it doesn't pollute as much. There's some troubles to it. I've told Janet, I think you ride our clutch. But it's worth trying. In the community of Christ in Washington, D.C., one day a week was a symbolic day for us. We lived on what we would have gotten had we been on welfare. It's just a symbol, just a gesture. At that point, it was 54 cents a person per day. So you live differently. You couldn't eat everything you normally ate. We found that we did a lot better if at least the evening meal we came together and put all the money together and had some potluck. And so it was a communal day, too. The money we saved, because we knew about what we would spend, we set aside, and at the end of the year, only eight families did that. At the end of the year, it was something around $3,000 that we gave to the hungry, that we had saved from eight of us eating differently once a week. It was just amazing. But the communal part was what helped make it celebrative. We fasted one day a week. And that evening, we had progressive non-dinners. We went to a house where we did not eat a salad or an appetizer. And we'd play a game, sing a song, put our coats on, go down the block where we didn't have a main course. I mean, it was a... You have to find a strange group of people, but they're usually fun if they're willing to do that, right? So there's a communal nature. And what about... Are we at all on target that what seems to be a very different theme about theology and salvation and a Judaizer circumcision debate, are we really onto something in the way of freedom? That's going to be tomorrow in a kind of summary. Let me end with a final story. A couple knew they were in trouble. It was getting dark. 8:30, 9 o'clock. They hadn't passed a motel for 2 hours, and the roads were narrow. They knew there wasn't another motel. They had a little car, couldn't sleep in it. They had no camping equipment at all. They were stuck for the night. So they did something they had never done in their life. They knocked on the door of a perfect stranger to say, could we spend the night with you? That's hard to do. Have you ever done it? They really felt funny. What they didn't know is they knocked at the door of a good-natured, friendly, hospitable Mennonite farmer who said, of course you can stay. I'm delighted you felt free to knock on our door. No problem. I made hay today. Go out to the barn. There's a ladder on the side. Go up in the loft. Spread it out a little bit. You'll sleep like a baby. And if there's anything you need, anything at all, you come and we'll show you how you can get along without it for one night. Have a good afternoon.